Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
My name is Ken Workman, and that translates into our native language, the language called Lushootseed. And that would be Yayus for work and Stobes for man. So Yayus Stobes. I am a Duwamish Tribal Council member, and we are in our Duwamish Longhouse.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and the longhouse we're in is right across the street from the Duwamish River. Ken grew up here in West Seattle, along the greenbelt that's above the longhouse, a place he recently went back to after many years.
When springtime would come, all the birds would start, you know, chirping and singing, and the air would become really sweet, and it was just heaven. And so as an adult, 50 years later when I go out there, it's difficult to recognize it because everything is now taller. The old trees are still there, so I recognize those. The creek is still there, although it's overgrown, and the water's pouring out of the hills, you know, because underground springs. So it would just gush out. You'd go, oh, look at that. And there would be that, what do they call that, fool's gold, you know, coming out of the ground. And I'd go, oh, look at that, if it was only real. But that's the imagination of little kids.
When Ken was a child, he knew about his Duwamish heritage, but was told to never speak of it to anyone.
It was very bad to be in Native American, very bad. It was so bad, Grandma never said anything about being Duwamish, and she took it to her grave. Great-grandma apparently knew the ways. She knew how to go down to the beach and just eat. She knew the berries to pick. She knew what the nettles were for and the mushrooms and all of that stuff.
And she might have known that Ken's great-great-great-great-grandfather, four greats in there, was Chief Self, the Duwamish leader Seattle is named after.
It's easier to say in Lushootseed. You just go, akw, yekw, akw, yekw. Means great, 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 great.
Ken, who's now in his early 60s, only learned of this about 10 years ago after a friend started researching his genealogy. Ken wishes he had known his heritage back when he was a child, running through those woods.
That's one of my biggest regrets, is that if I'd have known all of this a long, long time ago, of course my life would have been different. But it would also mean that for every day that I was alive, I would know about the woods, about the Duwamish, about the family tree. I would be in the fight. And so the Duwamish tribe itself today fights for federal recognition. And if I would have been known that back then, I'd have been part of that fight.
Ken is making up for lost time. He's getting in touch with his old self that he didn't know even existed. The great, 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 great grandson of a historical figure. He's immersing himself in a culture that what little he knew of, he was told to forget.
I would say encourage all your children to know who they are, and that who they are today is just a small piece of where they came from.
Today on Sound Effect, the theme is the old me. We're telling stories about people revisiting different versions of themselves. We'll talk to a former DJ who spends time with his old self in a new documentary. And we'll hear from a priest of a large Spanish-speaking congregation who talks about what it was like to be an immigration officer. These stories and more today on Sound Effect. Another direct descendant of Chief Self is part of our show today. His name was Henry Moses. He was a member of the Duwamish tribe, and he was the inspiration for Renton High School's mascot, the Indians. The Indians came into existence in 1920, and to be clear, this choice was not meant to be racist or blind to hurtful stereotypes. But almost a century has passed, and the lens through which this name is viewed has shifted. Back in 1920, the old Renton Indians were a source of pride connected to one person, Henry. Today, the name the Indians elicits feelings of shame from some students at Renton High School. How the Indians have been viewed by the local community over all these years is the focus of a new exhibit at the Renton History Museum. Sarah Sampson, the museum's curator, takes us back to the very beginning.
Back then, there was a Duwamish Native American named Henry Moses who was playing on the sports teams and attending the school. He was very athletically gifted, though he was short, but he was a good basketball player. And so he was a part of a basketball team that did really well, and other teams that they were playing against started calling them the Indians as a derogatory slur. And it was quite rare to see a Native American playing on a team with all of the white boys. During that time period, most Native Americans were either at boarding schools or they were not going to high school. So it was very rare, and they obviously did not react well to losing, and so they started calling them the Indians. Henry's teammates, and this is how the legend goes, Henry's teammates took on the name and said, yeah, we're the Indians. So they became known from that point as the Renton High School Indians.
Tell us a little bit more about Henry Moses. What was his family history like?
So Henry Moses belonged to the last remaining Duwamish family to live on their ancestral land in Renton. And they were right along the banks of the Black River, so they were able to maintain a fair amount of their native culture. They made and used traditional canoes, they fished salmon, and his mother prepared it. We have a lot of basketry in our collection that his mother and then other ancestors had made. As a whole, the communities definitely seemed to accept the Moses family as part of them. They were their neighbors. They lived amongst the white people as more and more of them moved in.
What did the early version of this mascot look like?
Very early on, they didn't actually use a visual representation of it. Back in those days, they were very frugal with how they did things, and so a lot of uniforms were even sometimes homemade. And so you were kind of lucky if it said Renton across it and that you matched decently well. It wasn't until really the 1950s when graphic depictions were used to represent the mascot.
And what did those look like?
Very stereotypical. They look kind of one of two ways. They would either be the stoic Native American who was very proud, or it would be kind of the more nefarious depiction of Native Americans. So, for example, the back of this band uniform that was used from 1968 to around 1984, it has a picture of a Native American, and since the school color is red, the Native American is red, so that touches on the whole red man, quote unquote. And he's carrying, it looks like, a tomahawk and is possibly marching off to use that tomahawk on somebody. Yeah, he looks very angry. And I do not have, you know, an exhaustive collection of everything that was ever used for the high school, but the things in our collection, not a single one of them actually looks Pacific Northwest Coast in nature, nor does it look Duwamish in nature.
Was there a time when the mascot for the high school got caught up in the debate over what mascots should look like and how Native Americans should be depicted?
Yes, when the 1970s rolled around, the student council actually took the project on and started down the road of trying to change it away from the Indian. And at that point, Henry was deceased, but his wife, Christina, was still living. And she actually wrote a letter to the school asking them to keep it, saying that Henry had always, he was always very proud that they had that name. The words that she said he said was that Indian stands for determination, bravery, and strength.
So the students were offended by their mascot, but Henry's wife was not.
It appears so. And I mean, they dropped the issue once they got the letter from her. And then the name has stayed the same since then. Though since the 1980s, the school's really kind of phased out using graphic depictions of Native Americans, and so they're just simply known as the Indians, and most of their jerseys don't even say the Indians, they just say Renton on them.
So has it faded out?
I know that there are still people who want it changed. We actually got input from 5 Native people within the high school today, 2 students and 3 employees, and all 5 of them expressed that they would like to see it changed. There was one participant who responded to us that said when he attended the school, he never told anybody that he was part Native. He always just said he was part Filipino because there was a lot of stereotypes being floated around about Native Americans, and a lot of it had to do with the name of the mascot, and he just was not comfortable explaining that to people.
How do you see the school going forward in preserving the history of Henry Moses and the role that he played, and yet honoring the feelings and emotions of current Native American students?
The school's actually done a really good job, as far as I can tell, introducing Henry Moses and explaining the history of him and the name to the students. In fact, there's a portrait of him hanging in the main office of the high school. But moving forward, it's clear that a lot of students aren't comfortable with it. And I don't know if they're going to stick with the name Indians and try to find a graphic representation that would be more maybe honoring Native American art, rather than ever using the depiction of a human being as an Indian again. But as far as I know, there's no official movement to change it right now, but there definitely have been rumblings about it.
When people come here and look at the exhibit you've put together and you've researched, what do you want people to come away with?
I just want them to understand the full history of it, from where it started in banding around Henry Moses and making him feel like he belonged, to, you know, the 50s through the 80s, which was really the heyday of using the stylized imagery that included a lot of negative stereotypes of Native Americans, and what that does to the Native American community, and what that does subconsciously to everybody that's taking those images in. Because if that's the only thing you're seeing about Native Americans, you're going to start to internalize these negative stereotypes about them.
That was Sarah Sampson with the Renton History Museum. You can check out this exhibit about Henry Moses and the Renton High School Indians at the museum until May 17th. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today's theme is the old me. And this next story is about what happens when you confront the old you head on. It's not easy to come face to face with your past. Nostalgia can be pretty painful. And this is definitely the case for Dick Rossetti. He was the afternoon DJ for Seattle's big alternative rock radio station, 107.7 The End, in the late 90s and the early 2000s. Lucked into the job, which is normally a super competitive gig that people who are funny on the air take very seriously off mic. This was not Dick Rossetti. This wasn't something he dreamed about doing. He was a rock and roll guy. He was in a band. But he gave it a shot, and he absolutely loved it. He loved being on live radio. And this was at the height of alt-rock music. Dick interviewed bands like The Strokes and Pearl Jam, and Dick would take calls and talk to listeners on the air.
You want to be a DJ? Give me your best DJ voice.
My best DJ voice?
Let's hear you be a DJ.
Me?
You can't be shy. You got to let people know that, hey, I'm here and I want to be a DJ.
Well, I'm here and I want to be a DJ.
Yeah, work on that a little bit. Look up DJ school in the phone book.
Dick also came up with some pretty funny local comedy bits. And for one joke, he asked a listener to come into the studio, this woman with an accent. I'll let Dick explain.
She had this amazing, like, Colombian Spanish voice. And she used to say, "I've been trying to get a hold of you, Mr. Dickie, for a long time." So I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, who are you? She's like, "My name is Monica." And I'm like, okay. We didn't have traffic reports. I go, "You have to come in and record these traffic reports for me." So I had her come in and do these generic, "I-5 is slow."
When someone lets you in, give them a wave so they know you are not a dong.
Not a dong. And then she was like my traffic girl with these 12 pre-canned things I would play every day.
Mr. Dickie Traffic. 167 South is always saggy on a Monday through Friday. Take a book to read and instant message people. It will kill some time so you don't anger as easy as when you arrive at your destination.
Dick was having a lot of fun. But he butted heads a lot with his corporate bosses, and he left 107.7 The End in 2006. but he kept recordings of nearly every hour he was on the air. Hundreds of cassette tapes.
Actually, I did it to get better because I would listen to every show and I wanted to get better. And so I'd just take them and I'd keep them. And there was a lot of them too that I would drive home and I'm like, this is the worst crap I have ever heard in my life. It's like, how can I do this? I am awful. And I would just throw them out the window. There's a lot of tapes too that are somewhere on the I-5 corridor.
Today, Dick and those hours of old recordings are the subject of a documentary by Tacoma filmmaker Isaac Olson. Isaac has been friends with Dick for over a decade, and he couldn't get enough of what was on these cassette tapes.
A format like this, where he would hit a button and just put a caller on the air, and he didn't know who he was, what he wanted, what he was going to say. You know, a format like that gives you a lot of opportunity to be creative. You know, that's why what he does could never be classified as a shock jock. There's nothing happening now like it. I don't know if you've listened to the end lately, but it's not that the DJs are bad. It's just not a DJ-driven format.
So you're saying that on these tapes, you heard radio, you heard a style, you heard stories that you weren't hearing anywhere else.
Yeah, I heard a world that doesn't exist anymore.
Not to sound like the old salt, but it won't again, though. Corporate radio now, you can't do anything anymore, you know?
So the two of them made a movie about Dick's glory days in commercial radio, and it was pretty weird for Dick to hear the old recordings again.
But I listened to this thing, and I told him, I don't know if I should get so depressed that I should off myself right now because the best years are in the rearview mirror, or celebrate it because this was amazing stuff. It was super funny, and it was a great time.
What was it like for you to revisit the old you?
It was depressing. It was horrible. It was pretty bad.
Why?
I went into therapy actually last summer because it was like, you're like thinking, man, is this it? Is this where your life, this is it? It tops out here, you know? It must be like what old newspapermen feel like, you know what I mean? It's just like, well, you know, I did that for a lot of years and gosh, they're not really doing it anymore too much. Well, I guess, yeah, I used to be a DJ. Gosh, we used to play some great records. And, you know, that guy. It's like, here he is. There's that guy. You know, he's still got his band that he can get 10 to 12 of his friends to come out to see. But, you know, he had a good run on radio back then. Sure he did.
What about that made you go into therapy?
Because a lot of the people that I did this stuff with are successful now. People that have, like, done things.
I've gone on and done things.
And you feel as though you haven't.
Well, I don't know if I should or I shouldn't. Because I'm not unhappy, though, you know what I mean? I'm not unhappy. I've got a great life, and I have five cats and my wife, and I play music, and it's great. But it's just like, I miss it, and, you know. And the thing that stinks is we were good at our jobs. We were great at our jobs.
But doesn't this experience of getting up close again with that time of your life, and you obviously loved what you did despite the obstacles of commercial radio that you had to overcome, doesn't it make you want to figure out a way to do it today? Because we have podcasts today, we have internet radio.
Yeah, and I have been doing that. I have a show on an internet station, and when we checked, there were 15 people listening, so it's quite a ratings juggernaut. Isaac and I had a podcast.
What was it called?
Same as the radio show, Underwhelmed. Underwhelmed, yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. Feel free to chop that out.
Well,
carte blanche.
Even though we live in this bold new world of everything being available right now and all the time, it was special back then in that there was a big machine behind it. And he's great doing a podcast, but he was best at that. And it is too bad that is not around.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what it is? It is. And you're going to bleep this out, but you know what I miss? I miss the of the world. I miss them. Those were my people and I miss them.
And you had
like
a direct
Cro-Mags.
You had a direct line to them.
I did. I had a direct line to them. And I miss them.
On the radio!
No!
Yeah!
No!
Yeah!
This is the DJ! It's okay to be up there by yourself, but it's more fun to knock stuff around with other people.
They were kind of your partners,
yeah,
right?
They were my. That's what I thought of them, as my co-host.
If you'd like to spend more time with Dick and his past, the film premieres on June 18th at the Grand Cinema in Tacoma. This is Sound Effect, and I'm Jennifer Wing. Today, our theme is the old me. You know, that role you used to play, that thing you used to do, but don't anymore. Lane Chaplinsky is the artistic director for On the Boards, a contemporary theater space in Seattle's Queen Anne neighborhood. But for a brief time, Lane lived another life. During college, while Lane pursued a degree in English and studied Shakespeare, he also played basketball for the University of Kansas under coach Roy Williams. And for people who don't follow college basketball, this was a really big deal. The Kansas Jayhawks, they're one of the most successful teams in college basketball.
A Kansas comeback for the history books. Rock Chalk Championship. Kansas takes the title.
It's a basketball powerhouse. Wilt Chamberlain played for Kansas. Lane spoke about this old version of himself and some pretty incredible timing that happened to him at this point in his life with Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad. We start with Lane, who tells Kevin that he was thrilled just to make it onto the university's junior varsity basketball team.
I wasn't just playing against JV players, but I was playing against all the other varsity players, especially in the summer times. And so by the time I was a junior, we ended up having the best record the JV team had ever had. And so I thought it was the end of my career, and it was a good way to go out at that point.
Okay, so senior year rolls around. Tell me a little bit about senior year at Kansas for you.
Well, the summer before, I went and studied abroad at the suggestion of a late English teacher of mine, and I went to Stratford and to London to a theater program. I had taken a lot of Shakespeare in school, and so I went just to study theater, and I came back in the fall. I ended up auditioning for the fall auditions and ended up getting cast in this play by Brecht, The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy, and a couple weeks into rehearsals, I get a phone call from Mark Turgeon, who's now the coach at University of Maryland. He was my JV basketball coach. And he asked me what I had been up to. And he said, well, hey, our freshman point guard is not going to be able to play this year. And Coach Williams asked who the best player on the JV team was. And I said it was you and that you also happen to be a point guard. And so we're curious if you'd like to come over and practice with us. So I ran over to the field house, put on tennis shoes, and started shooting jump shots with really no expectation that what this meant or anything was going to come of it. And so later that day, there I was out on the court with, you know, one of the best basketball teams in the country.
What happened next?
Yeah, they said that Coach Williams was pleased with my participation, and he wanted to schedule a meeting with me and said that they'd like me to join the team for the rest of the season. And he made very clear that my role was to be a practice player, to show up on time, not screw up, and really help the other players get ready to play and help make them as good as they possibly could be.
They asked you to join the team, but also you'd been cast for this theater production. Yeah, that seems like kind of an unusual crossover Division I athlete and someone in a theater production. You don't see that all the time.
Yeah, it was weird. So I'd go to basketball practice, and then I would eat peanut butter sandwiches and drink Gatorade on my way across the street to the building where theater rehearsal was. And so that was afterwards. And for a couple weeks, for a period of time, those two worlds didn't collide. But then at one point, the student body started to catch on that I was in both. And that was then kind of heightened because the kids who wore the capes and the cutout basketball heads or helmets, I knew a couple of them. And so they started chanting to get me into the games.
So during the games, they start from the crowd.
Early on, we'd get way ahead and they'd start going, Lane, Lane, Lane. Well, people really got into that. And so the, you know, 17,000 people would start chanting that and they would stick around to see if I got in. I remember the first time it happened, Coach Williams looked down at me like, what in the hell is going on? This isn't what we signed up for. Then he would throw me in and people go crazy, and they'd even go crazier if I could score. You know, we'd be on ESPN and they'd chant my name. I'd get in and Dick Vitale would start going, they want him, baby. They want the actor. They want little Lane Chaplinsky. You know, there was that kind of surreal thing going on.
It didn't stop with you being sort of the 11th or 12th man on this high-level basketball team and having people chant your name. There, you were made a captain.
Yeah.
That had to mean a lot to you.
Oh, it was huge. I mean, I you know, truth be told, I had always been a leader. You know, I remember there was a picture of me in the city paper when I was in preschool, and the caption said, these other two kids were looking at me demonstrate how to fly an airplane or something. And they said, look, little Lane Chaplinsky shows them how to do it. I remember being my senior class president. I was always telling people what to do. So, yeah, it felt good, and I felt like that's where I fit in.
How are captains sort of immortalized at Kansas?
There's a wall, I think, with a plaque of everybody who's played at the university. And then there's a captain's wall where it denotes captains. And I'm right beside this guy, Will Chamberlain, which becomes a fun bar topic of conversation when I show that picture to people, because I can say that, you know, the comparisons will never end, and people just, you know, the guy's dead and they keep still comparing us to one another. I think it also had something to do with where our last names fall alphabetically, but I don't really focus on that so much.
From my understanding, the sort of influence of Kansas basketball didn't really end when you graduated.
That's true. I ended up penning a basketball book called Making the Basketball Team Get Off the Bench and Into the Game. And I asked Coach Williams to write a forward for me. And not many people have access to a Hall of Fame basketball coach to write a forward for a book. So when I was sitting in his office, I asked him to write the forward. And then he said, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? And I said, I'm going to work in the arts, but I don't really know what that means. And he ended up calling a woman named Jackie Davis, who ran the Lead Center, which was the Performing Arts Center at the University of Kansas, where an organization that had been responsible for me seeing, you know, all these different performances that had been brought into campus. And so I went and met her, and a couple months later, I ended up getting a job offer, an opportunity to go work as an event coordinator. And that was effectively the beginning of my arts administration career, which is, you know, about 23 years ago.
A lot of the time you'll hear a performance artist go on a particular stage at a particular venue and occasionally refer to it, if it's an old venue or a popular venue, as spiritual. You'll hear athletes say the same thing if they're in an arena. Was there anything spiritual about walking onto this arena, walking out onto the floor at Kansas?
Yeah, actually, and it's the same thing that I experience it on the boards in a very different way. So Allen Fieldhouse is one of the most special places to watch sports, period. I still have this really strong feeling of being in the field house by myself in the summertime, shooting jumpers. And I swear you could hear voices. You could feel the presence from above, from history, from everything around it. And I don't even think just basketball players. I think everyone who had come through that building, who had come through that community, and who used to congregate there on the occasion to watch basketball. I actually feel that same thing and on the boards. You know, that building was Queen Anne Hall previously. It was built in 1912 as a community center. And it's actually a very haunted building, and you can hear voices and you can feel that presence. And it's not just artists, but I think it's everyone who's been through that building over that very long period of time. So it's interesting to think about what community engenders that way and what kind of presence it creates in the moment, but also what it potentially leaves behind. And I think you can feel that whether you're at Allen Fieldhouse or at on the boards.
That was Lane Chaplinsky speaking with sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad. Lane is leaving on the boards. He's headed to Ohio State University, where he'll be the director of performing arts at the Wexner Center for the Arts. You're tuned to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX, and today's theme is the old me. And we are changing all the time by new experiences, people we meet, the work that we do. And you might start a career loving your job, and years later, you might have a completely different feeling about your work. Father Antonio Ias is the pastor for St. Matthew San Mateo Episcopal Church in Auburn, Washington. And on the day we meet, he gives me a tour of a building behind the church. He points to a sign on the door that reads,
"No human being is illegal. We are all humans, right?" No.
St. Matthew San Mateo is a sanctuary church. If an undocumented person or an entire family wanted to stay away from immigration agents and try to avoid being deported, they could live here for a while. No one is being housed here right now, but Father Ias wants the community in this small town that fades into farmland to know that this is a safe place. Just a few years ago, Father Ias was someone who wouldn't have necessarily been welcomed here. Starting in 1988, he was Agent Ias. He worked for the Department of Immigration and Naturalization Service and U.S. Customs. Today, it's U.S. Immigration Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Antonio's job was to find men and women who were undocumented, people who committed a crime, and to build a case against them so they could be removed from the United States.
It was very rewarding trying to remove or put behind bars someone who would make life miserable for another human being as a young agent. At the end of the day, I seriously believe that one was doing the right thing, locking up people who do bad, bad things out there.
So how did this man go from doing this kind of work to becoming a priest declaring that everyone is legal? Antonio was born and raised on the west side of Puerto Rico, a part of the island with beautiful beaches and pineapple fields. He moved to Connecticut for high school, and then he stayed there for college. He studied history. He never intended to work in law enforcement. When he was just out of college, he went to a job fair. The federal government was on a hiring spree for new immigration agents.
And ironically, I came across this agency because President Ronald Reagan had signed 2 years earlier the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which was the law back in the late 80s that granted amnesty, and over 3 million undocumented immigrants became legal permanent residents, and many of those are nowadays citizens. That was my beginning of my professional career.
When you were a special agent, would you have been directed to go after populations that are being targeted today?
You don't know where the current administration is coming from, because everybody becomes a priority. So you can have from a single mom of two U.S. citizen children being arrested and removed. At the same time, you could have the criminal alien walking the street because you are putting concentrating resources all over the place. So I don't see an organized way of establishing priorities. That's the difference of what I can see now.
When you were doing the work as an immigration officer, it sounds like it would be correct to say you're very proud of the work that you did during those years.
Yes, I thought I was doing the right thing and that I was being effective in what I was doing.
Why did you want to get out?
I started thinking about it, and after several years as an agent, as I looked more and got older in age, got more gray hair and life experience, I began to see the inequities or injustice in the system, how some people can get away with it, and sometimes the most vulnerable are sometimes even victims of the system. So it's the inequality and the I would say now, and it's my belief, some of the policies are very unjust.
Was there a specific case or an example, a human interaction that you had on the job that made you start to feel that way?
One example that I still carry to this day, it's in an enforcement action in Queens, in New York, that was a priority back then, fining employers who hired undocumented immigrants. And in one of those enforcement actions, I remember coming across a young woman from Colombia, a very hard worker that you could see, a person that was trying to make the American dream a reality in her life. No criminal record, no criminal association. Her only crime, per se, was that she was here undocumented. And that day, she ended up being removed because she was working, no documents. And again, someone with no criminal record, a young lady in school, you know, she was trying to live the American dream, and it all collapsed through the actions of an enforcement action. She was removed. So that's very unfair when there is no recourse because of the way the laws are written and policy is written. There is no waiver in the statutes to grant this person the benefit of staying or adjusting her undocumented status. So those are real stories that you can see. It's, you know, it's people that you're dealing with. So that's one case in particular, but many cases make you think about it.
With that young woman, what did you say to her at the time? What was your conversation with her?
There is not much that one can say or one can deviate from the process because of the legal system that it's in place. So not much interaction as a human being.
It was that inability to speak, to reach out human to human, that tore Antonio up inside. He retired 10 years early and entered the priesthood with the Episcopal Church. The calling to this religious vocation was a constant voice he shared with few people. The work he is doing today is so different from his old job. As an agent, he would ask people, "Do you have proper documentation today?"
I don't ask anybody if they are undocumented or documented. And even sometimes I don't even ask people where they are from. We are all humans from the planet.
Just as Father Antonio didn't speak about his desire to become a priest with his federal agent coworkers, he doesn't speak much about his past to his parishioners. But if he is asked, he's completely transparent. In fact, on one of the bookcases in his office, there's a certificate. It's from March 1st, 2003, and it says this: "Be it known that Antonio Ias is a founding member of the Department of Homeland Security." The few times undocumented parishioners have sought advice from Father Antonio, they not only have found a sympathetic ear from a man who wants to be an agent of change, but a man of faith who knows much more than the average priest about current immigration laws and policies. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Sound Effect. And again, today we're telling stories about the old me, a version of ourselves that is different from who we are today. My old me was left inside the hallways of South Philadelphia High School in the summer of 1989. South Philly High was not my regular school. My public school was all girls. You had to do well on a test to get in. And once you were there, expectations were really high. I was struggling, and I kind of just stopped caring. I got an F in geometry. South Philly High was where I had to retake the class. And those few weeks inside that building made me really appreciate my school, where the bathrooms didn't have bodily fluids on the walls or in the sinks. And no one tried to set your shirt on fire with a cigarette. Summer school in 1989 at South Philly High was
absolutely terrifying, but it was a much needed kick in the pants. I was reformed and I thrived in school from that point forward. The student who turns things around, the old version, a failure, the new one suddenly has a future. This is something that Seattle writer Mike Long experienced. When it happened to him, he was in the fourth grade, growing up in Indiana.
I was one of the kids that you see in every class. There's like one boy, or there's a couple of boys, maybe some girls, but usually the boys that are off, like staring off into space or drawing something on their notebook when they're supposed to be paying attention, or they're just obviously not interested.
Mike's teachers tried everything. Nothing worked.
The teachers always had these different discipline techniques. So there was the name on the board thing. I spent most of elementary school with my name on the board for one thing or another. I just didn't pay attention to anything. I just had like zero attention span for anything that I wasn't completely interested in. And that included almost everything in school.
Mike would have rather been lost inside a book.
I was really into The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. So I'd read those books and I even got the records. They had records for The Hobbit. And I listened to that record constantly.
So if you're reading Lord of the Rings and your parents see this, and then they see you coming home with the report cards full of
D's, pretty much. D's are worse.
They must have been kind of frustrated.
Oh yeah, they were horrified, because my mom's, she had been valedictorian of her high school, and she'd barely ever gotten a B in her entire life. And I think she viewed my grades as sort of an extension of herself. So when I would bring things home like that, I think it was really traumatizing to her. It wasn't traumatizing to me at all until it was traumatizing to her.
What things did your parents try to do to improve your grades?
They tried lots of things. They tried a lot of things that involved doctors. And I don't even know what all the doctors did. I mean, some of it involved various drugs, but the worst one was definitely the crawling. That was the most memorable out of all the therapies.
Yes, you heard that right. Crawling, like a baby.
So my dad somehow heard about Dr. Smithson, and he explained to my parents that my academic problems, or the academic problems of a lot of children, as I understood it, were caused because they didn't crawl enough as toddlers. And that, I had really bad handwriting. So what I think it was that somehow your bad handwriting caused you not to be frustrated when you were doing schoolwork. And the reason you had the bad handwriting to begin with was because you didn't crawl enough as a child. My dad would, I think it was pretty much start crawling. He wasn't having it. He just told me, you know, start crawling.
And crawling is not a euphemism for something else. We're talking about literally getting on the ground on your hands and knees.
Yeah. And yeah, that's exactly what it is. And crawling. And so I had to do it 40 laps around the house. But the problem with it was, since the doctor's theory was that I hadn't crawled enough as a toddler, they needed to make it really have a big impact. So in order for it to have an impact, they had different resistance techniques when you crawled. So what would happen would, your parent would crawl with you, and they would either push your shoulders back or hold your feet in a certain way that made it harder.
So can you give us a visual of what this looked like?
We went through all the carpeted areas of the house because it was not fun to crawl on tiled floors. So we'd crawl down the hallway. We'd go through my parents' bedroom. At the far end of their bedroom, there was a wooden plaque inscribed with the Lord's Prayer. And then I would turn at that plaque, because that indicated that I had half a lap done, and start crawling back. And my parents would have to go right along with me. They were usually holding my feet, kind of crawling behind me, holding my feet. One of my parents, they didn't have, both of them didn't have to do it, only one at a time. It was really humiliating for everyone involved.
Would your mom be watching and correcting you?
Yeah, especially at first. She was really concerned that we do it the exact way that this doctor had come up with, because she didn't want to waste. I mean, she does everything exact. So she'd always be leaning over and looking and seeing if my elbow was in the right place or my hand was in the right place, that type of thing.
And this happened every day?
Every day, yeah.
For how long?
It was at least several months.
What would you say to your parent who you were crawling with on that particular day? What kind of conversation would you have with them?
Oh, we wouldn't talk much while we were doing it, but beforehand we would always have a fight.
What would you tell them?
That I wasn't going to do it, flat out. There's no way I was going to do it. I mean, it was humiliating. Even at 10, you don't want your friends to find out that you have to crawl around your house with a parent attached for half an hour each night. That's not something you want anybody to know. And so my parents, at the time I was collected football cards. That was my reward for doing the crawling each week, was that I would get a pack of football cards or two packs of football cards. But I remember there were several times I just was like absolutely refused to do it. And that was when she would usually break out the football cards.
Did their belief in this therapy ever falter?
It started to look like it was working. My handwriting was actually improving. But it was only improving because I didn't want to crawl around the house. So I figured I better put in a little more effort. Which, luckily, I'd set the bar so low. If I did anything else, it probably would have looked like a giant success.
It did work. It sounds like it got the ball rolling to get you to kind of buck up a bit.
About halfway through fourth grade, I really started to care. And then I really started to try. And I got straight A's by fifth grade. I mean, I think it was one of the first times I actually realized that I was going to need some level of discipline.
Do you remember when it ended? What that day was like? What was going through your mind when you were processing the news that you didn't have to do this anymore?
I mean, I remember being really, really happy that I didn't have to crawl. And I also remember I had the most amazing collection of football cards, probably within the metropolitan Indianapolis. I mean, I had a lot of football cards.
Mike Long, he lives in Seattle. Once Mike made it into college, he and his parents eventually were able to talk about the laps they did around the house and to laugh about it. He says that he doesn't feel any ill will towards them. They're all speaking. In fact, he says he's grateful that they invested the time on the floor with him. He says that without this humiliating experience, he might have never turned things around at school. Several years ago, Mike became a parent, and when his daughter was a baby and was learning how to crawl, he felt absolutely no need to prolong this phase in her life. We're now at the end of the show. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Parker Miles Blum is our go-to guy for pictures and some of the videos you see online. Special thanks this week goes out to Mike Lewis and to 88.5's Bellamy Palethorpe. Our intern is Amanda Abbott, and you can find Sound Effect on the NPR One app. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. We'll be back next week when our theme is Peace of Mind.
And we were a prominent family, and then to have that be ripped from you in a sense, and to be ostracized and lied about and bullied, and then to come through that on the other end, though, I'm not bitter or jealous or even angry.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.